A student opened fire yesterday at Mattoon High School, injuring another student. Mattoon Police Chief Jeff Branson says it could have been much worse if a teacher hadn't subdued the shooter.
With a quick response to the teacher, if that teacher had not responded as quickly as they had, I think the situation would have been a lot different.
That audio courtesy of WEIU in Charleston. We'll talk with the editor of a newspaper in Mattoon to get the latest on this situation, and we'll talk with a licensed therapist about how schools can respond to traumatic events. Plus, a Filipino food and arts festival in Chicago is in its third year, and this year they're showcasing Filipino chefs from the Midwest. And we're learning about two unique attractions happening in Illinois right now, Snake Road in Shawnee National Forest and a Chicago Cubs corn maze. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. Students at Mattoon High School in East Central Illinois are back in classes today, a day after police say one student shot and injured a classmate in the cafeteria. The alleged shooter was subdued by a teacher and is in police custody. The victim was taken to a local hospital in stable condition. Both the alleged shooter and the injured student are juveniles, and police have not released their names. Mattoon School's Superintendent Larry Lilly said the victim was in good spirits. The superintendent talked about the effect on the school and the community at a news conference last night.
We are saddened that this event has happened, and we will provide counseling to our students in need. We will continue to work with our emergency personnel to determine what happened. We appreciate the quick response of school staff and our first responders. Most importantly, we offer our thoughts and prayers to the injured student and all who are affected by this tragedy.
That audio courtesy of WEIU in Charleston. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a licensed therapist who specializes in helping communities deal with traumatic events like this. But first, an update on what we know and don't know about what happened yesterday. We're joined on the phone now by Penny Weaver. She's the editor at the Mattoon Journal-Gazette and Times Courier. The paper covered the story throughout the day yesterday. Penny, thanks for joining us today on the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Penny, starting off, what can you tell us about the mood at Mattoon High School today?
Well, the students were going back in this morning with police presence at the front doors. I haven't been over to the high school, but one of our reporters was, and everything seemed to be operating as normal as can be after something like this.
Sure. Can you just briefly remind us exactly what happened yesterday at the high school?
Well, it was approximately 11:30, and there were shots fired by a male student in the cafeteria. One of the teachers, whom we have now identified as Angela McQueen, subdued the shooter, and a police officer who is at the school as part of community policing then disarmed the shooter. And in the meantime, of course, the students were evacuated from the building quickly. They were taken to different areas outside the building, safe zones. Police from many area agencies immediately headed that direction and converged on the school. The high school students were all either some of them walked, I think, some of them were taken by buses over to Riddle Elementary School, which is relatively close to the high school, and then their parents could go and pick them up there. One student was wounded and taken to Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital, we believe, although the hospital does not release information about patients. Anyway, he is hospitalized in stable condition. At least one other student was injured, possibly by gunfire, but we have not confirmed that. But overall, just one student was injured. No one else had any injury from a gunshot or anything, and the suspect was in custody immediately.
Penny, do we know anything about why this shooting occurred at this point?
We do. Our reporting this morning has confirmed that this student was bullied. Beyond that, of course, we have not had time, and of course the school district won't release information about juveniles, But we do know that bullying was involved somehow in this incident.
When you say that, you mean that the alleged shooter was being bullied and this was a response to that?
Yes, that's what we believe has happened. Well, as I said, we've not confirmed that with police, but through other sources, we do know the student was bullied.
Okay. And Penny, how has the community been responding to the events of yesterday?
Well, it's been a large outpouring of support for each other. There was a prayer vigil held last night. More than 200 people attended. There were several pastors who spoke and at least one city council member. People are really banding together. There is, of course, huge support for the young man who was shot. And on social media and elsewhere, people are just supporting each other and coming together as a community.
Penny Weaver, editor of the Journal-Gazette and Times-Courier in Mattoon. Penny, thanks so much for the update today.
Hey, thanks.
As we heard, Mattoon High School is taking a number of steps to make sure students, families, and school staff are supported after what happened yesterday. Gun violence is a growing problem in many communities in Illinois. Still, shootings inside of a school building are much less frequent. Researchers have learned a lot over the years about the trauma experienced by students and the support they need after events like this one. Karen Sims specializes in helping communities facing trauma. She's a licensed therapist based in Indiana with Meridian K Consulting and joins us now by phone. Karen, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Doing okay, thank you. We're talking here in general terms because there's still so much we don't know about exactly what happened yesterday and why. We are hearing more and more about gun violence, but this shooting happened yesterday inside a school. Is that an important distinction when it comes to trauma and how people respond?
Yes, but first I want to say, I want to echo major sympathies and condolences to everyone impacted by the shooting in Mattoon, because I know it has a huge footprint. But one of the things that we know from the research about school shootings in particularly is that because schools become sort of a symbol of safety for most people, right? Most people believe that when they send their kids to school, the kids will be safe, and that students in the building believe that they are safe. There's sort of a bubble. And when there's a shooting inside of a school, there's a bursting of that bubble. And that leaves lots of people feeling like the school, that bubble that's supposed to keep people safe, is unsafe. And so, again, the footprint can be very impactful because, when you lose those echo, those emblems of I can go there, it can be predictable, it's normal, human beings love feelings of safety and predictability, it can just be disruptive.
At least some students are back in the high school today, but they're dismissing early, just after noon today. Presumably, that means that they won't be back in that cafeteria today. Do you see that often after an event like this, trying to keep students away from the scene of the violence?
Well, absolutely, in part because people want to. There are two instincts. One is people want to restore a sense of normalcy, so they want people to return back to normal, sometimes pushing that envelope too much, right? Because when something significant happens, from a mental health perspective, it's important to acknowledge that it was significant. But then I can imagine that the school has sort of figured out that, and again, I don't know them, but sometimes the school's temptation is to, again, return back to business as usual, but reducing sort of the intellectual and the emotional burden of the incident. So I can imagine the school sort of vacillated back and forth and thought this was a sort of happy medium to sort of reduce something that could be potentially triggering for people, but also to help, again, return back to an original sort of pace and rhythm and routine. One caveat I will say is if you are a parent or somebody in the community and whose student was exhibiting any sort of anxiety, fear, or had concerns about going back to school, honoring those fears and really respecting those fears is highly recommended because forcing folks to go back into environments that are triggering or potentially stressful, particularly in the immediate aftermath, can have some potential long-term impacts and consequences. So one of the strong recommendations is to listen to your students, listen to yourself, listen to your voice. And I was looking at a couple articles, and the people who tend to be missed in these conversations are teachers and school administrators. And so I guess I want to say the same thing that we would recommend for students, we'd also recommend for teachers, is if it feels too stressful, trust that.
And we should add that the district has said that any parents who wanted to keep their students home today, that those would be excused absences. Karen, is there any research into trauma among students after shootings in a school?
So we don't have research on, and again, I'm not minimizing the impact, but on sort of minor, and again, not minimizing this, but a lot of the research has been on the impact of mass shootings. So when there have been multiple people shooting, and what the research has found is after those mass shootings, anywhere between 15 to 20% of students and adults who've been involved in those shootings will exhibit some signs of PTSD. That's a pretty significant impact. So, and those signs can happen up to 4 years after the incident. So this isn't like something that has a short-term impact. What I will hope is that, and all the footprints are there, is that when communities do things to help repair relationships, to support students and families, to there are recommendations where you provide lots of positive, affirming activities where families are really mobilized to support students and each other. Those kinds of things tend to mitigate the long-term impact. And again, so Mattoon and other communities that are impacted by these discrete incidents really have the opportunity to sort of reduce the harm. But it requires lots of intentional, focused approach. And so I want to recommend a couple of things, and you may not be at the point for recommendations, but there are things like youth mental health first aid, which is a strategy that helps everyone working with youth and children understand both signs and symptoms of potential impact, so adverse impact from trauma and other negative events, but also gives people practical tools that they can use to assess for trauma, sort of like Red Cross, like it helps people assess for possible adverse symptoms, but also respond to them in really strength-based ways. There are other kinds of things that through the National Child Traumatic Stress Network has other tools for both families and schools to use after a trauma. So I guess I want to say being really intentional about looking for solutions is what's highly recommended, but it does require everybody being involved.
Karen, most people listening to this conversation were not inside Mattoon High School yesterday, but they may be hearing about what happened on radio, TV, online, and their kids might be listening or reading over their shoulder. Can that second or third hand exposure also have an effect, especially on younger children?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we recommend, and this is about the news of the day anyway, that can be stressful for a lot of people, but especially your emotionally sensitive kids and adults. So if you have somebody who normally tunes into the news, seems adversely affected by it, you're just as sensitive, they will have. So I want to take one step back. So trauma isn't just what you experience directly, right? We tend to think about your direct experiences, but exposures can be traumatic for a lot for people. So we think about traumas being events, experiences, and exposures. So listening to the news, hearing people talk about it, all of those things for some people can create just the same level of anxiety and stress as if you had a direct impact. So encouraging parents to be careful about what you're listening to, what kind of conversations you're having, how you talk about it. And again, if you see any symptoms in your kids, problems with sleeping, any regressive behaviors, any like sort of anything that looks abnormal, more quiet, more reserved, more not wanting to do things, wanting to not be involved in things, paying attention to those signs intervene early, and if they don't get better by, like, you intervening, talking to your kid regularly, then it's time to seek some additional help. But definitely stuff the news out.
Sure. You know, members of the community around Mattoon, many of them came out for a candlelight vigil last night. You had a lot of people coming together to show their support. Can moments of like that help?
Yes, it can help. And like any period of grief and loss, knowing that when the help might be needed is not necessarily in the immediate. It's a long term. So it's, where do people come in a month from now that still are having issues and need to talk about it? And that can still be those informal groups, those community groups. It doesn't have to be a professional group, but there needs to be a long-term strategy for people. And so as a community, it's really helpful to be mobilizing, thinking about how is it that we have ongoing conversations, that we help restore students' sense of safety, that we talk about it as a community, where we go from here, and then implement a plan to deal with that.
And Karen, we just have a minute left here, but one final question. Schools often have counselors and clergy in the building after an act of violence. What role can they play in the immediate time afterward?
So again, what they're going to be doing is basically some psychoeducational work and listening, doing some initial listening and allowing people to talk about fears and concerns and to deal with those things. What we know from a mental health perspective and just sort of, Ray, is that those conversations are just initial conversations. So if you're a parent or community member, know that that counselor in the school or clergy in the school who's having those initial conversations isn't going to be the fix. So know that it, like for all of us, if you think about a stressful day at work, generally we need multiple conversations, right? Like if you have a really bad day, you got fired, you're going to need to talk to someone probably more than once.
All right, Karen, and I think we're going to have to leave it right there. We're out of time today, but Karen Sims with Meridian K Consulting, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Filipino-Americans are the second largest group of Asian Americans in the U.S. Nearly 140,000 live here in Illinois. But Filipino food and culture aren't as well represented, both in the restaurant scene and in popular media. The Cultura Festival in Chicago is a food and arts festival for people who are both personally connected to Filipino culture and for the uninitiated. It's taking place at the Emporium Arcade Bar in Chicago this Sunday. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a professor and a chef from the Philippines. But first, joining us on the line from Chicago is Natalia Rojas. She's co-founder of Filipino Kitchen and organizer of the Cultura Festival. Natalia, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is the third year now of the Cultura Festival in Chicago, and it started mainly as a food festival, though it is expanding this year. But why is food a good way to both introduce newcomers to Filipino culture and to provide space for people who are already connected to it? What's so unique about food?
I think what's unique about food is such a universal theme. Like, it doesn't matter how you get to know a culture is usually through food, or at least that's how myself and Sarah Lynn, who is my business partner and my best friend, travel. Like, we get to know a culture, we get to know a place through the food. Then stories come behind those food. Then you get to meet the people who create the food. Then the people where they got the food from, like farmers. So I think food is such a centric thing. And no matter what our differences is, by the end of the day, we all need to eat.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things you're highlighting this year is Filipino chefs from the Midwest. Why is that important to you?
Because, like, growing up here in the Midwest, like, looking around, and every time we would travel either in the West Coast or the East Coast, it feels like there's such a vibrant Filipino-American community, and yet you come back home and you look around, and it's like, Where's my people? So I think it's very much right now a reflection of how we grew up not having that kind of space, like not like San Francisco or LA or New York, that they always have like Philippine centers. They always have their Filipino fiestas and all these different celebrations. And whereas we do have some here in Chicago, but not entirely in the Midwest. So we created that space for us to call our own and actually be able to express ourselves.
Now, I understand this year, Natalia, that you're featuring chefs, but also lecturers, musicians, and performers. Maybe in some broad strokes here, what can visitors expect to see?
Besides the good food, we have amazing performers like Soul Tree. She is a undocumented artist that would be performing. Also is RV Mendoza from Detroit. They are a queer disco Philippinex disco queen, I think was the tag, but you know, another great a performance locals hip-hop group called the Whoever's. And we have like house DJs. We have a two-time Hugo awardee that's going to do a panel on science fiction and food. Then, you know, online with you next is like, you know, Professor Martin, who's also going to go talk about like food history. We have somebody talking about food justice. So on top of that, we also have people coming from the West Coast who are Baybayin expert, which is Christian Kabuay. Baybayin is our indigenous script. Mm-hmm. And then we have seven community partners that represent Filipino Americans, Asian Americans, LGBTQ community. So it's all in one house.
Yeah. It sounds outstanding. You know, this is the third year now of the Cultura Festival. How has the event changed over the years?
I think, as you mentioned earlier, like, you know, we started primarily as like having food, and yet we thought about it, like Sierra Lynn and I have both like a lot of festival experience, mainly music festivals like Lollapalooza, Bonnaroo, Coachella, those kind of things. We've worked at it, and we kind of just applied those different festivals and kind of made it our own. As we expanded, as we thought about it, I was like, food may be the gateway, but that is one facet of our community. What about the artist? What about this academics? What about, you know, visual artists as well, and also different community partners? I think, you know, we wanted to be as well-rounded as possible.
Sure. Can you tell us, Natalia, are there still tickets? How much are they? Where can people find them?
Yes, there are still tickets. Online ticket sales is going to shut down on Saturday at 9 p.m. And tickets are $20, and you get five Cultura dollars to spend on food with it. Then we also have student rates, which is $10. Seniors is $5, and kids 0 to 6 is free, and 6 to 12 is $5. You can also purchase Cultura dollars on site. At the door, it will be $25 with no Cultura dollars. The website is https://ti.to/ Filipino-kitchen/Cultura Festival. All of this can also be found in our website at Filipino.kitchen.
Okay, great. That's Natalia Rojas, co-founder of Filipino Kitchen and co-organizer of the Cultura Festival in Chicago. Again, that's this Sunday at the Emporium Arcade Bar. And we'll tweet out all the information that Natalia just gave us if you follow us at 21STShow. Natalia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And I want to bring two more people into this conversation who will be featured at Cultura. Sharwin T is a chef and TV host based in the Philippines. Martine Matalanson is an associate professor of anthropology and head of Asian American Studies at the University of Illinois. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Sharwin, let's start with you. You've talked about how you'd like to introduce a different side of Filipino food from the more traditional dishes. Can you tell us first about those traditional dishes and then the different sides you'd like to showcase this year?
Yes. I was at Cultura last year, and so I'm trying to bring in as many new dishes as I can, because I feel like a lot of our Filipino chefs here in Chicago and in the Midwest, they're really doing a great job of doing the more famous Filipino dishes. So what I'm trying to do now is just bring in some of the dishes that may not be as well known and hopefully spark some more creativity among all the chefs here. So I'm doing a couple of dishes from the Chinese Filipino side of our cuisine, which is a Chinese version of the lumpia, and a fritter called okoy, which is fried shrimp and vegetable fritters. And then I'm bringing in a very, very traditional dish called ginataang halo-halo, which is a dessert made of coconut milk, vegetables, and fruits as well.
And lumpia, that's like a spring roll, correct?
Yes. Well, that's the thing I'm trying to debunk is that there are many forms of lumpia in the Philippines. And what I'm trying to do now is bring in a fresher version. So the Chinese Filipino families actually cook their filling first and then serve it with either a lettuce cup or a spring roll wrapper. And so we're trying to give a vegan option to the festival, but also at the same time showcase that other side of Filipino cuisine, which is the Chinese Filipino cuisine.
Sharwin, you're from the Philippines, and I imagine you're surrounded by other Filipinos and Filipino food. What's it like to come here to the U.S. and cook with Filipino-American chefs?
Oh, I'm loving it. The one thing that's really surprised me is how much of their families they bring into the food. I was thinking coming in maybe last year that a lot of the Filipino food here would be, you know, too much of America and too little of Filipino. But what I've realized is a lot of our young chefs here, especially around the Midwest, are doing family recipes and just modernizing some of the techniques. And that's really inspired me because I'm seeing Filipino food in different contexts, like they're serving it differently or they're cooking it differently. But when I close my eyes and I eat, it tastes just like in the Philippines.
Is there an example of that stands out to you?
Well, there's many, but this year I think people would be surprised to find, for example, Hapa Chicago is doing a sandwich that has kare-kare, which is a traditional oxtail stew, but this time they're using a smoked beef brisket, which they've smoked overnight. So this is, again, very, very different. You know, there's an American aspect to it with the smoking of the beef brisket, but at the same time that kare-kare sauce tastes just like home. So putting that together makes perfect sense here in Cultura.
Sounds delicious. Martin, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here. I imagine you're planning to eat at Cultura this weekend, but you're also there to give a talk. And as I understand it's about kind of breaking down this myth that there's one static definition of authentic Filipino food. Why do you feel like that's important to talk about at this Filipino Food Festival?
Well, I think what Natalia and Chef Sharwin has just talked about, there are these traditions that, in fact, are practiced, but are always changing. And so, in fact, what Chef Sharwin just talked about, the kare-kare sandwich, is part of, I think, that one of the fundamental things about tradition itself and of cooking as a culinary art. It depends not so much on recipes that you follow again and again. And, you know, you find that even in ordinary household, people improvise, people put in secret ingredients, right? Home cooks do that as well as chefs. So one thing I wanted to bring in is the idea that we should be a bit more careful when we say things are authentic or not, thinking about the way the Filipinos, for instance, as a people, are distributed all over the world. With its global diaspora, the fact that they live in different countries, even as they try to stick close to the tradition, they are remaking tradition in their own way, as much as, you know, the Filipino-American families here, the chefs and all that are creating, adapting these traditions and putting in creative touches, if you will. So nothing is ever really tradition is never really just this one thing that you practice, because year after year, you know, people create new things, you know, put in, like, even for Christmas, for, you know, people think Christmas is the same. Yes, there are certain aspects of, let's say, of a tradition, let's say a dish like kare kare, which I would imagine would have a base that would have a flavor profile that's similar, but using different techniques and different ingredients. So I think what the takeaway from my lecture is really an advocacy for an openness to both new things while maintaining an attachment to or an affection to the long-standing tradition.
And your talk, Martin, is called "This Is Not My Mother's Adobo." Is that title maybe a bit ironic given all that you've said about traditions changing?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny because adobo, for instance, people say that's the national dish. The idea of a national dish is tricky. Unlike, let's say, the Pad Thai of Thailand, where the Thai government actually mandated a recipe, right? Adobo is like most other dishes where there are regional differences, you know, individual idiosyncratic differences. My mother, for instance, and I grew up in my father's side of the family, but my mother brought in from the southern part of the main island, Luzon, the use of coconut cream in adobo, which my father's family and, you know, my siblings and I found abominable. We didn't like our adobo with coconut cream. But at the same time, you know, because my father's family used something quite not mainstream, you know, it comes from their part of the Philippines, and it's mostly vinegar and some fish sauce. The mainstream one, that what people think is the national dish, is really vinegar and soy sauce. So to say that there's one adobo is, you know, it's really tricky, right? So it is an ironic take because I actually hated my mother's adobo. But nevertheless, recognizing the fact that, yeah, there's no one authentic adobo, because people say, well, people from my mother's part of family would say, this is the real adobo. This is the adobo we want. But, you know, there's so many things, you know, in and this is not just true in the notion of a national cuisine in the Philippines, you know, China, you know, when we say Chinese cuisine, the thing that we have grown to be familiar with is really Cantonese cuisine. And it's only, I would say, in the late 20th century that other regional Chinese cuisine came in. Mm-hmm. So I guess one thing I wanted to people to take away with from the lecture is, in fact, this openness and this critical eye for maybe, I mean, I would go as far as saying that maybe authenticity should be thrown out, so to speak, because authenticity just creates this kind of false myth of one singular origin or one singular recipe.
Sure.
When in fact you find a proliferation of it, and the best thing isn't so much an attachment to the idea of authenticity, but an openness to the varieties, the ways in which people in different places adapt their dishes, well, even if they're called the same name, to particular ingredients, particular tastes, and all that, right?
Sure, sure. I think we'll have to leave it right there. This has been a fascinating conversation for me. Charwin T. and Martin Manalansan, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And again, we'll tweet out all the details about this event coming up. It's the Cultura Festival in Chicago. It's this Sunday at the Emporium Arcade Bar, and we'll tweet out all of the details about where to get tickets and everything else at our Twitter account. That's at 21STShow. Stay tuned. Still much more to come here on the 21st Show. We'll learn about Snake Road down in southern Illinois, and we'll also learn about a Cubs corn maze in the northern part of the state. Stay with us. That's still to come today on the 21st. First.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st today. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Every September through October, Illinois wildlife officials strategically shut down a 2.5-mile stretch of road that runs through Shawnee National Forest in the southern part of the state. If you're familiar with the area, you may know the spot as LaRue Road or Forest Service Road number 345. Or perhaps you know the spot by its slightly more famous name, Snake Road. About 3/5 of Illinois' reptiles, including snakes, and roughly 2/3 of its amphibians make their homes in the broader area surrounding Snake Road. Officials have closed the roadway every year since 1972 to protect snakes, frogs, salamanders, and newts from speeding cars as they migrate from their summer to winter habitats. Illinois Department of Natural Resources herpetologist Scott Ballard is on the line from Marion to help us learn more about Snake Road and the cold-blooded creatures crossing it. Scott, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
When people hear that a road is closed off because of a massive snake migration, some people might start picturing pools of slithering snakes right out of an Indiana Jones movie. Can you kind of paint a picture for us of what Snake Road looks like right now?
Yeah, it's a very gradual migration. We've had several requests from television shows internationally to come down and film this, thinking that there's just piles of snakes writhing on the road. And actually, it's a very gradual migration. So the two-month closure allows the early migrators to come across, and then during the middle of the migration period, you have the majority of them, and then you'll have some stragglers towards the end of that migration period. So if you walk that entire road with the 2.5-mile stretch and see 20 snakes, you're doing really good, because then on the way back you could see 20 more or 30 more. So it's kind of a gradual thing. It's not that they all gang up on the road and sit there and to amaze onlookers.
Sure. Snake Road is closed to cars, but walkers are free to visit. What are some of the animals that they might see there on a typical day?
The most common snake there is the cottonmouth water moccasin. That is the most predominant species a person will see. But there are other species there. Timber rattlesnakes occur there. Copperheads occur there. King snakes, rat snakes, worm snakes, ribbon snakes, garter snakes, water snakes, two or three different species of water snakes. And then, of course, the whole myriad of turtles, amphibians, lizards. There's three different species of lizards that occur there. So if you're on there on a good day, you can get to see quite a bit.
And are any of those endangered species?
Yeah, there's three or four endangered species of snakes and endangered species of frog that occurs there. And so the migration, the two-month period, certainly doesn't stop all vehicular mortality of animals, but it does protect the majority of the population.
Where are all these creatures coming from, and where are they going during this migration?
During the March and April time frames, they're coming down out of the limestone cliff outcrops that are on the west side of LaRue Road 345. They're gradually moving across the road into the swamp where they'll feed, reproduce, all that during the summer. And then as the photo period, the day lengths get shorter and the night temperatures get cooler, they start their trek in September and October of coming back up onto the road, crossing it, going back up into the limestone cliffs to hibernate in.
Is it common elsewhere through the national park system to completely block off a road like this?
To my knowledge, this is the only place in the entire United States that's closed off for a biennial reptile and amphibian migration.
Interesting. And Scott, I understand you were actually pretty instrumental in the information gathering and decision-making behind closing Snake Road. Can you give us a little bit of that backstory?
Yeah, when the Forest Service started doing this, which was a really brave step for the Forest Service to do in 1972, they closed it off for 3 weeks in the spring and 3 weeks in the fall. And I happened to be doing my graduate work at Southern Illinois University at the right time, and so I monitored the road for several years just to kind of see when the periods of activity was. And what I found was that 3 weeks in the spring and 3 weeks in the fall wasn't enough. So in my master's thesis, I recommended a longer road closure and actually stipulated dates, and they did adopt that. So now it's closed from March 15th to May 15th in the spring and September 1st, October 30th in the fall.
And just a quick follow-up there, with the climate starting to change, has there been any thought to maybe adjusting those dates at all?
Well, we have looked into that, and actually the Forest Service has been very good conservation partners. If we get down there and we have a warmer than normal spring and we do see snakes moving earlier and we talk to them about it, they will go ahead and close the road a little earlier.
Okay. People know that from September through October, there are some very reptiles gathering around Snake Road. And over the years in your work with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, you've been involved with cases involving the illegal capturing and trading of these animals. Has that been a problem specifically at Snake Road?
It has at Snake Road. I mean, you know, the positive spin to, because with the onset of social media, I mean, the Forest Service publicized this a lot prior to social media. And then once you have so very many social media outlets, now everybody, all they have to do is Google Snake Road, and boom, they know where it's at. There's maps and everything. The good thing about that is it shows that it is important to conserve reptiles and amphibians. They're very important parts of our ecosystem. They control a lot of insect and rodent pests. It's good that they're not killed. The downside to it is if someone doesn't have the right intention and the whole area is closed to collecting. So if someone thinks, oh, this would be a good place to go grab two or three pets or two or three animals I can sell illegally in the pet trade, unfortunately, it draws those people too. But we do make cases down there every spring and fall for people either harassing the animals or collecting them, or even we've had a couple instances where we've caught people killing them down there.
Scott, what advice do you have for people traveling to Snake Road who want to make sure that they stay safe and, of course, keep the wildlife safe?
I would certainly wear, I wouldn't go down there in shorts and flip-flops. I would not take pets there. Since we do have three different species of venomous snakes down there, and when you walk the road, sometimes the snakes may be in the leaves on the shoulder of the road, and if you're not watching where you walk and you step on one, it will bite, just like if you were to pick up a raccoon or a fox, it would bite. These animals are not aggressive. They're not going to come after you, but you need to have the right footwear on. So I recommend leather boots that come up past your ankle. It's like denim jeans, just not bare legs. And please don't take your pets down there, because a lot of these animals musk when they get frightened. And that odor is attractive to dogs especially, that may go up there and smell an odd smell and put their nose right on one and they end up getting bitten in the face.
Mm. And Scott, before we let you go, I have to ask you, where did you get your love for reptiles and amphibians?
I unfortunately had dog and cat allergies, so I was allergic to their dander, and my mother brought me home a snake as a pet for my 10-year birthday, and I had to educate my dad that and he was wrong in thinking the only good snake was a dead snake, and so from there, it's just kind of snowballed.
Scott Ballard, Illinois Department of Natural Resources herpetologist, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Sure, thank you for the opportunity, Brian, I appreciate it.
While the baseball playoffs once again are a possibility for Chicago Cubs fans, many are still celebrating last year's historic World Series win. In Spring Grove, Illinois, about 70 miles north of Chicago, the Richardson Adventure Farm's annual corn maze is decked out in a Cubs theme this year. Here to tell us a little bit more about the maze is George Richardson, one of the owners. George, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
Yeah, same here, George. I understand you've made corn mazes with different themes every year, and this year it's about the Cubs World Series win. What can you tell us about what this corn maze actually looks like?
Well, we specialize in a fantastic picture. It's 28 acres, and there's 10.2 miles of trails that draw this intricate design. So we like it to look really spectacular. This season, I mean, we received permission from the Cubs to use the logo, which is big and central in the maze. It's probably about 300 or 400 feet in diameter. And then off on the upper right, we've got the Wrigley Field marquee spelling out the World Champs 2016. And off on the upper right corner, Harry Carey is up in the clouds yelling, "Holy cow," as this is signature catchphrase that he had for many, many years before he passed away.
Oh, very nice. Did you know right when the Cubs won the World Series last year that this would be your theme this year for the maze?
Well, yes, although I tease people that I knew in mid-season that this would be the year, and they'd always ask me, what's next year's theme? I said, well, the Cubs, of course.
Very nice. Is this something that you do every year for a different theme? And what can you tell us about some past themes of your maze?
Last year was an interesting one. We celebrated the 50th anniversary of Star Trek TV series, and we got permission from NBC to use the 50th anniversary logo. And, you know, there's a new Star Trek series coming out real soon. And so they were happy to help us publicize Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, wonderful.
Before that, we've had the Girl Scouts 100th anniversary, the Boy Scouts 100th anniversary, different things like that. We've had the Bears and the White Sox, and when they won their World Series in 2006, or 2005, was it?
Yeah, 2005. Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun. What can you tell us about how long it actually takes to walk through the maze?
Walking through is... it's about an hour and a half, seems like. If a person wants to get all of the checkpoints in the maze and solve the entire maze, about an hour and a half. But it's split into four different sections, and we designed the trails with no dead ends, or very few. Like, I think Harry Carey's chin has a dead end because, it needed that line to make his face. But it's relatively easy to get in and out of the maze. So a person can go in for 20, 30, 40 minutes, whatever they want, come back out, get a drink, go to the bathroom, get a hot chocolate, ride the train, whatever, and then go back in and pick up where they left off. So, some people don't want to do the whole entire thing. They just want a taste of it and then enjoy some of the 30 different activities that we have around the grounds.
Now, I don't know if this is ever any kind of a competition, but what's the fastest someone has made it through the entire maze?
let's see. You know what? Honestly, I haven't heard this year. So.
Okay, no problem. When is the maze open?
We open on September 2nd, the Labor Day weekend, and we're going to go all the way through October 29th, Sunday, October 29th.
And what's been the reaction so far?
Oh, phenomenal. The press and the Facebook coverage with the Cubs theme is just absolutely wonderful. Over a million views on our Facebook pages when we put that picture out. People are really excited about it. And I find that even the guys that come wearing their Sox jerseys, they're good-natured about it. And the Wisconsinites, you should do the Brewers. I said, well, hey, have them win the World Series. I'll do the Brewers next year.
There you go.
Everybody's good-natured about it.
Yeah, that's good. Are there some Easter eggs hidden in there or any other little nods to Cubs history inside the maze?
We have some quiz questions. One part of our maze, which takes about 20, 25 minutes or so, has quiz questions to guide you through that, and there are some Cubs questions, some corn questions, I think some 50s trivia or something, just kind of a fun way to do that, one part of the maze.
And what was it like, working with the Cubs organization to get approval for this project?
Well, they were very good. We easily found the CEO of Harry Carey Restaurants and all of that, and he gave us permission right away, so this would be fantastic. Whenever you're dealing with a large organization like the Cubs, the Bears, NBC last year for Star Trek, it's not hard to get the permission, but it's hard to find that right person somewhere up in the hierarchy that can give you permission. Like, okay, well, this isn't going to hurt anything. Maybe it's kind of a nice little tribute. So they've been great to work with.
And finally, George, before we let you go here, the Cubs have had a little bit of a struggle this season, but they're looking pretty good for making the playoffs. Are you expecting to make another Cubs maze next year?
I don't know. Probably we'll do a different theme, but I have no idea what. So.
All right. Very good.
January, February, March, April, we work on what that theme is going to be and what the design is. So we enjoy, making a spectacular picture.
George Richardson, the owner of Richardson Adventure Farm in Spring Grove, about 70 miles north of Chicago. George, thanks so much for joining us today on the 21st.
You're welcome. And richardsonfarm.com has all the information for directions and all the 30 different activities of the slide, train, carousel, everything like that that's included with admission.
Wonderful. And we'll tweet out all that information as well from our Twitter account at 21STShow. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We tweet during the show with more analysis and background. And on our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, Bob Holly, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.